Lowe's knows that more projects mean more tools. For a limited time, new and existing MyLowe's Rewards credit card members can get 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more, in-store and online. Don't wait to get the things you need. Get special financing today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Now through August 27th, choose 12-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more. Offer subject to credit approval and cannot be combined. Minimum monthly payments required. See store or Lowe's.com for details.
Warning, this podcast contains adult language, including two shits, a fuck, a piss, another fuck, dick, jizz, another fuck, motherfucker, bitch, two more shits, cunt, cock, fucktard, fuck nozzle, several assholes, more fucks.
Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by the new chain of pre-apocalyptic rapture supply outlets, Genesis 7-Eleven. Because now that they're letting the queers get married, you know God's judgment can't be far off. Mention this ad and get a free set of swimmies with any purchase of $20 or more. Genesis 7-Eleven. Thank you, Jesus. Come again. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
No country has ever fallen while it was truly honoring the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So if you were completely atheistic, but you wanted to have a free country and you wanted to have it safe and protected, that it might be a good thing to encourage those who believe in God to keep doing so.
I'm Evan Bernstein from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and we did, in fact, evolve from filthy monkey men.
Thursday.
It's December 12th.
And my ass is less of a J-Lo and more of a C-Lo.
I'm No Illusions.
I'm Heath Enright.
And from Coniferous New York, New York, this is The Scathing Atheist.
In this week's episode, we'll learn that it's hard to roll R's with a dick in your mouth.
We'll find out that everyone has an equal right to discriminate against gays.
And the perfect plump roundness of Rush Limbaugh's face is related to pie.
But first, the diatribe. Tennessee is the buckle of the Bible Belt. South Georgia is the taint. That works out well, because clearly the Florida panhandle is the scrotum, so unless you consider the Mississippi Delta to be the asshole, in which case coastal Alabama is the taint, South Georgia is the de facto Bible taint. And boy, what a taint it is. I should know, I spent a big chunk of my childhood there. Spent six formative years of my life living in a place where the two accepted religious affiliations were Baptist and devil worshiper. Where you had to drive to a theater two towns away to see something blasphemous like, I shit you not, Wayne's World. Where church groups organized dozens of people to protest a comic book shop because they were promoting, I continue to shit you not, Dungeons and Dragons. The principal at my high school led the students in prayer during the morning announcements and before each football game. My 10th grade English teacher once spent an entire hour telling us about the dangers of Satanism. And my 9th grade science teacher once told us that gays were an abomination against God and should be dragged into the street and shot. Actually said that in front of a fucking classroom of 9th graders. Religion was everywhere. It was in the school. It was in the mall. It was protesting in front of the movies. It was showing up uninvited at the house. It was scolding me from every church sign. It was staring at me from the bumper of every pickup truck. It was blessing me from every cash register. It was blockading me from every girlfriend's vagina. It was inescapable, in charge, and insane. And the stories they believed weren't just crazy. They were fucking silly. I couldn't comprehend how anyone would take them seriously. I remember walking past church services and wondering if it was all an elaborate hoax that everyone was in on but me. I felt like I was the only sane person on the planet. I just wanted to grab people as they came out of church and say, can't we at least agree that this is exactly what religion would look like if it was just made up out of whole cloth to oppress people? Can't we at least agree that if a 10-year-old was lying about his invisible pet alien, he would use the exact same debate tactics that you guys use? Can't we at least agree that taking this book about dragons and talking donkeys and resurrected Jews seriously without asking for a shred of tangible evidence is functionally indistinguishable from clinical nincompoopery? I couldn't understand it. Many of these people were reasonable and far more intelligent than me when we weren't talking about resurrected Jewish messiahs. But as soon as that subject came up, otherwise rational human beings would start spouting proofs that they'd never accept in any non-religious circumstance. All of a sudden, basic moral precepts like burning people for eternity is wrong and babies aren't evil sinners fly out the fucking window. And for years, I just wrote these folks off as stupid, and it's damn tempting to do it. It's damn tempting to laugh off the Chicken Little campaigns against Harry Potter books and World of Warcraft and say that they're the products of misguided, uninformed, paranoid idiots. But if you leave it there, you're underestimating them. And you're also underestimating the consequences of growing up in a town that was willing to rise up as one to keep the scourge of Wayne's World from the local youth. Religion can only survive on ignorance. Information is the Achilles heel of faith, and unless they control everything a person watches or plays or reads or learns, nobody's ever going to buy into their bullshit. They won't be able to shut the critical parts of their brain down in those critical moments. They have to fight against everything because it takes a lot of work to make people continue to believe in demonic snakes and octocenturion arc builders. But there was no internet back then. See, there was no way to fact-check them when they controlled the bookstores and the libraries and the schools. A kid could feel like he or she was the only person in the world with a fully functioning brain. There was no internet, there were no forums, no wikis, no podcasts, no blogs. And maybe when you strip away all the post-hoc justifications, that's the real reason I do this show. Just to know that when religion dies, I'll have been a small contributor to the murder weapon.
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is fellow brain in a jar, Heath Enright. Heath, are you ready to dismiss hard solipsism due to its lack of functional consequence?
Dismiss what?
There you go, then.
In our lead story tonight, Al-Azhar, a prestigious Islamic university in Cairo, released a study last month examining the fatwas issued by Islamic theocrats in Egypt during the one-year reign of Mohamed Morsi that ended in July of this year. It's common sense stuff, like, you know, avoid creating a comfortable rape environment by turning off the air conditioner when you expect your heat-sensitive rapist neighbor might stop by. Stuff like that. Just, you know, simple things you can think about.
And
as a woman,
much as I'd love to say you made that up, nope, that's a real fatwa.
That's a real one. Now, there was another decree that prohibited women from handling bananas, cucumbers, and other phallic flora. That's right. You know, stuff that they might shove inside themselves in rabid seizures of uncontrollable female desire, because that kind of thing happens. Now, lesbians were also banned from buying almonds, curtains, and modern art, and also from existing in the country,
point. Yeah. Of course, there was also a fatwa against having sex naked, so you never know exactly which gender you're fucking, if you think about it. You're just taking their word for it, kind of.
Now, my favorite fatwa was issued in response to a clever group of Muslim adulteresses. Turns out the word for ocean is a masculine noun.
What?
And that's right. If the wrong arbitrary linguistic gender assignment touches your wife's vagina, that's adultery.
Wow.
Some reason, though, it's perfectly normal for men to swim in a sea of dicks.
Right.
Like, that's perfectly acceptable.
Just don't swallow. Salty as fuck.
I'm told. The Muslim Brotherhood showcased a surprisingly good string of puns, though, they did, when they released the following headline in conjunction with the adultery swim fatwa. Quote, boys on the tide, sticky situation in the perversion gulf as married women swim in gland shark infested waters seeking saltwater staffy and motion in the brotion. End quote.
Wow.
That's right. That was pretty good string. They got like four or five in there. Sounded a lot like me. I got to give them credit.
They're good. I'm just saying that I'm adding the Adultery Swim Channel's existence to Jetpack and the Darth Vader butt plug in case Santa is listening.
He's checking it twice. Now, here's the problem with this whole thing, though. The Arabic word for nothing is also masculine, which means she's got to put something in there, right? but only about half the things are eligible, so it gets tricky for her. I mean, like, book, but not page, finger, but not knuckle, shaft, but not tip. Like, and again, no veggies, so, you know, what's a girl to do? It's impossible.
Right? It's tough. And in Satan debating news tonight, devil's advocate, posthumous lesbianator, and head of the New York-based satanic temple, Lucian Graves, has made it back into the news this week by filing a request to place a satanic monument on the steps of the Oklahoma State House.
Fantastic.
Right next to the one with the Ten Commandments
Even
on it.
Better.
Graves argues that if the space is reserved for religious displays, his religion has as much right to it as any other. Unfortunately, of course, for the Oklahoma theocrats, the stupid laws that they've recently enacted accidentally agree with him. When asked about the possibility of a satanic monument, Representative Bobby Cleveland dismissed the idea and the Satanists behind it as falling, quote, under the nut category.
Okay.
And not because believing in a giant red monster with a pitchfork that tempts humanity and runs the HR department in Hades is nutty, by the way. He has other reasons.
No.
Thinking there.
So to them, the notion that Lex Luthor exists is ridiculous, but
right.
Superman's obviously real.
Exactly, yes.
And from the Pope's parting velvet ropes file, Catholicism's Rico Chart Topper told Italian churchgoers that he gained valuable experience as a bouncer at a nightclub in Argentina, where it was also very important to correctly identify the age of a minor, no matter what type of tip they offered. Now, his only regret was jumping right into the priesthood before he got experience working the rear entrance a little bit more. It would have been
nice.
Useful, I guess.
I wonder how the Union of Argentinian Bouncers has taken this news, you know? I think on the one hand, they might be thinking of using it in their advertising, you know, bounce today, pontificate tomorrow. But on the other hand, it's got to knock your badass image down three or four spots when people know that your job could be done by, like, the elderly hybridization of Woody Allen and Droopy Dog.
He does simultaneously look like those two characters slash people. To bolster his reputation as, you know, the People's Supreme Pontiff, whatever the fuck that means, Pope Frangioplasty made sure to mention that before he was even known as Reverend Jorge Beer Goggles, he was just a normal blue-collar guy, you know, checking fugitive Nazi IDs, sweeping floors, figuring out how to become, you know, humanity's conduit to the implied omnipotent watchmaker of the universe.
Normal
Joe the Plumber guy stuff.
And in the Who Would Jesus shit can file tonight, we have the story of Michael Griffin, a former teacher at the Holy Ghost Preparatory School in Bensalem, Pennsylvania, who was a current teacher at the Holy Ghost Preparatory School in Bensalem, Pennsylvania, until administrators recently found evidence that he was trying to marry a dude.
Trying, okay.
Yeah.
It's weird that they find the attempt to marry more offensive than the premarital butt sex. I mean,
right.
It's just, what are they focusing on?
I don't know, but because U.S. law somehow protects the rights of Catholic institutions to write in a no-sucking-off-dudes clause into an employment contract, this bullshit is apparently legal. When asked how being gay married could possibly affect the performance of a Spanish and French teacher, an imaginary representative of the school explained that, quote, sure, being gay probably helps you with French, but this guy's got to teach Spanish, too.
Spanish is also gay, come on.
Well, they roll their tongues.
And in Rush versus the Holy Triumvirate news, Rush Limbaugh is furious at Pope Fran O'Domini for endangering the Republican Party's delicate Christianity hijack mission by reminding Catholics that Jesus, as well as kindergarten, both teach that sharing is nice. Limbaugh probably thinks the Pope's just bitter over losing to him in a jowl roundness contest last month. That's what I'm guessing.
I'm dying to know how that thing's judged.
Several criteria, yeah.
I'm picturing, like, they both hold, like, one of those little Japanese drums from Karate Kid 2 under their chins. They just kind of flop their heads back and forth. Zhao beats it in a rhythm, you know, most hits wins.
Yeah. So the octo-chinned conservative Casey Kasem, who labeled the Pope's sharing remarks as, quote, pure Marxism, became an expert economist while failing to graduate from Southeast Missouri State. Now, in fairness, for all we know, he could have breezed right through at his safety school, which I believe was West Northwest Southeast Missouri A&M. So, you know.
Go paddlefish.
You seem to know all of those.
I do. I looked it up.
Limbaugh released a segment called It's Sad How Wrong Pope Francis Is, parentheses, unless it's a deliberate mistranslation by leftists. So, built into his title, in parentheses, as if almost tacitly understood, is the claim that liberal spies have likely infiltrated the English translation department at the Vatican for the purposes of sneaking references to Das Kapital into the Pope's translated speeches, thus undermining American capitalism, I guess? I have no idea.
He's not the best in the business for nothing, man. Glenn Beck would have needed 10 minutes and a chalkboard to connect all that shit. Rush Limbaugh does it in 14 words and some brackets. Bravo, sir.
Absolutely. Now, in honor of shitty Christian commentators, as well as yellow and brown journalists everywhere, let's put 30 seconds on the clock. Christian assholes as shit porn stars. Go. I'll start out with a topical Flush Limbaugh.
Nice.
Just as a courtesy, Flush Limbaugh.
Okay. Bowel Osteen. No, wait. I'm going to go again. That sounded better before I said it. Joel Osteen.
It's better on the way out, yes. All right. Or Bowl Osteen, maybe.
Okay, yeah, that would work.
Or No, hold on. Bowel Sharpton. Bowel Sharpton.
Or how about Bowley Graham?
Nice. And speaking of stretching the bowels, Bran Coulter. Because it's, you know, the roughage.
Yes, yeah, right. Brick Perry.
Nice. Dick Santorum's too easy. I can do better than that. Wolf Schitzer.
Cardinal Timothy Colon.
Excellent. Deuce Almighty.
Pope Francespool.
L. Ron Buggard.
No, he's a Scientologist. That's not fair. Like, my first thought was Shit Romney, but I didn't use him because Mormonism is a cult. He's not a Christian.
Fair enough. Anal Roberts. Or Rod, Anal Roberts.
T.P. Jakes.
Nice. Toilet Paper Jakes. Scat Robertson. Two-Ply Jakes. Scat Robertson.
Well, I hate to pinch off the poop puns early. That's always painful. But we're out of time, Heath. Thanks for hanging out.
Sayonara.
And when we return, Lucinda will join us to ruin her chances at a future political career. I suppose that if I was a deity who fashioned the earth and the seas, then covered it all up in creatures and made some subordinate me's, and I had a message I wanted to send them, something that I thought was vital, I'd probably write them a list of instructions, or at least divinely inspire a Bible. It'd be hard to decide what to tell them, though, since the book could be only so long. I'd want them to know there was purpose and to know the right path from the wrong, and I'd stress over what to include there, and I'd stress over what to omit. After all, there's a lot more to say than the space of one single book would permit. See, I'd want to impart on them knowledge and show them the value of peace, and I'd probably want to include something in it about the nature of germs and disease. Should I remind them not to rape women? Or not to make people work without pay? Should I tell them they can't beat their children or beat off more than four times a day? Should I explain that the sun's in the center or the value of washing with soap? Should I explain in unmistakable terms that there's always a reason for hope? Well, according to God, the most wise course of action is to leave out all of those things and make sure there's plenty of space that's left over for a long list of Israel's kings. But I guess that's why I don't write Bibles and I'm just some anonymous tit and he's the all-knowing creator of all and the Alpha Omega and shit. If you read my book, you'd know to be thoughtful and to let people love who they choose, but I'd fuck up and leave out important details like who led the 6th century BCE Jews. I'd have skipped all the stuff about Solomon and the temple he built for the Lord, and instead I'd have told them how telescopes work and what wonders they might point them towards. I'd have droned on and on about hygiene, wasting time on nutritional facts, and forgotten to mention who was leading the Jews when the Philistine army attacks. I'd have pissed away pages on problems that they would face as their populace grows, and I've probably put some stuff in I can't fathom that only a deity knows. I'd have wasted a couple of chapters on equality of genders and races, and I'd have forgotten to smite them and punish their children for pillars and poles in high places. I suppose that if I were to write it, you'd have questions at the end of the tome, like how long did it take for the third king of Israel to finish building his solid gold home? So I'll submit that as I'm just a mortal, I can't fathom a deity's ways, but from my perspective, it's fair to conclude that he sure writes in mysterious phrase.
The Holy Babel.
1 Kings, because God knows that you can never get enough mythologized Jewish history. I swear this book babbles endlessly about a series of Israel's kings as though it was daring you to keep reading.
And I think the singular is pronounced king.
Right?
No S, not trying to be a dick.
So joining Heath and me to celebrate being 1/6 of the way through this book, you can already hear her giggling in the background, is my beautiful wife, Lucinda. Lucinda, welcome back.
Always happy to be here, Noah.
The book is pretty linear at this point, so there's no need to set anything up. This basically starts right where 2 Samuel ends.
Now King David is old and sick, and we have to decide who gets to be the next king.
But before we get to all that, we have to tell you about the king's new hooker, who he wasn't fucking.
Right. She was just keeping him warm.
She wasn't jerking me off. She was trying to start a fire with my cock. Just rubbing two sticks together. There's a second dick in the picture, I understand. But yeah, just roll with it.
Yeah, King David was so cold that his doctor prescribed him a new virgin. And then Solomon became king, and his brother Adonijah, or however the fuck you pronounce that, was more than a little pissed about it.
The talent pool in the desert must have been running dry a little bit at this point, considering the most attractive woman in the land is named, what was it, Abishag the Shunammite? Sounds more like an orc general from Lord of the Rings. It's an awful name for a hot chick in a book.
And then we get this touching bit where David takes Solomon aside. You know, the violins are playing as he offers his final words, and it's just basically a list of people he wants Solomon to kill.
Right, including Shimei, the dude that David promised not to kill in the previous chapter. So all I said was I wouldn't kill him. I never said anything about right. you or other hired assassins. That wasn't in the contract. Somebody else can kill him.
And then Adonijah says, hey, bro, since you got the whole kingdom and everything, you think I could have Dad's new hooker?
Please?
Be awesome. Solomon says no and then kills him for asking.
And then Solomon proves he's super wise again by threatening to cut a baby in half, famously.
Which is, yes, yeah, exactly. And it's just as fucked up as it sounds, too. You got two women each accusing each other of killing their baby and swapping him out for a living one.
Smart, you gotta admit.
Which is fucked up enough before David starts threatening to split babies down the middle.
Yeah, so naturally the real mom says, no, don't chop the baby in half, you fucking psycho. But the other lady's like, yeah, that makes sense. I'll take half a baby.
Which half?
Yeah, it is enough for a stew, after all.
Yeah, it is.
And this is Solomon's, like, tagline moment. This is his yippee-ki-yay mother truckers. Like, this defining biblical event is an episode of Judge Judo, and he settles a maternity dispute between a murderous whore and a regular whore.
And then chapter 4 is basically a list of Solomon's cabinet, a list of what he eats, and a list of people that he was smarter than.
And they make very sure to mention that he spake 3,000 proverbs and wrote 1,005 songs, which is clearly bullshit. There's most obviously made-up numbers I've ever heard. There's no way he hits exactly 3,000 proverbs and exactly 1,000 songs, and then he can't resist writing 5 shitty extra jingles. You'd stop at 1,000 there, or you'd at least tell them to write it was 1,000.
Everybody was kung ju
yeah, right.
fighting. No, I'm done. Done at 1,000.
Kung Ju fighting.
Enough.
Rhymes with Jew.
And then Solomon gets the wheels turning on his new temple. And let me tell you, that is going to be one bitchin'-ass temple.
Yeah, and in case you were wondering, say, how many cubits wide the nave was or how many sides the doorposts have, that's what Chapter 6 is all about.
So. All about. And for all his help building the temple and shit, Solomon gives Haram 20 cities, but apparently they were his 20 crappiest cities.
Baltic and Mediterranean.
Yeah, right. Yeah. This whole book of the Bible is like going on a date with a rich douche. Every few sentences we're hearing about Solomon's throne or his golden vessels or his fleets or his platinum butt plug.
I think we call this a teachable moment. Jews should only put the rarest of metals in their palace and in their ass. Platinum butt plug reference.
And in chapter 10, I'm pretty sure it brags about him fucking the Queen of Sheba, too. Mm-hmm.
Indeed. I believe it said he gave her everything she desired and a taste of the royal bounty on top. That was
salty.
Said in my translation. So I'm pretty sure they fucked, and it sounds like they even got a milk and honey shot in there at the end. You know,
well done.
A little shuckle shot. Salty indeed.
And in case you were wondering what kind of mileage he's getting with that dick of his, in chapter 11, it actually starts with the words, Solomon loved many foreign women. And it went on to describe his harem of more than 1,000 wives.
Yeah, this guy spread more STDs to minorities than the Tuskegee experiment.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Ouch.
It's a syphilis joke.
Yes,
time in
yes.
U.S. history.
And if I learned anything from this book, when the vaginas show up, trouble can't be far behind. So, of course, his wife's talking him into turning against God and offering burnt offerings to other gods, so real God concocts this convoluted, multi-generational revenge plot.
And then the kingdom was divided because God likes to go over his shoulder to scratch his fucking ass.
And they open 2 movie burgers.
Yeah, right.
Straight to the golden calves again.
So you got Jeroboam, who God gives a chunk of his kingdom to, and he's an asshole as well. He starts making non-Levite priests, so God sends a prophet to tell Jeroboam that the shit's about to hit the fan.
And then God kills the prophet with a fucking lion for eating food and drinking water.
Right.
And he falls for the oldest trick in the book. Some guy walks up to him. Are you a prophet? From God, get the fuck out of here. Me too. Let's go eat or something. Oh, you have a note from God that says don't eat. This is so crazy. I have a note also from God. It says that you should disregard your note and go eat with me, after which you will definitely not be mauled by a tiger. So don't even worry about it. Why would you even bring that up? That's not superfluous information. You won't be mauled by a tiger.
So basically, you got Jeroboam running Israel into the ground, and at the same time, you got Rehoboam fucking things up in Judah. They can't get a good king.
Yeah, apparently they were making high places, pillars and sacred poles and shit. Yeah, I don't
know. What was that?
And if that's not bad enough, and it is, they're temple prostitutes for the wrong gender.
Thing is, man whores just aren't as cost-effective, you know, from an orifice perspective. It's, to be fair, it's less bang for your buck, you know, despite more schmeckle for your shekel.
Yeah, well, you get that going.
More schmeckle for shekel. Shekel, schmeckle.
Is it just me, or is, like, is this book of the Bible pissed at you for reading it? You know, you keep getting this stuff like it, and it'll say, "And are not the acts of Abijam written in the annals of the kings of Judah?" So what the fuck are you reading this book for? Go read this other book. We already wrote this shit.
You guys didn't read one of the three other books in Hebrew existence already? Jesus.
And during the unending war between Israel and Judah, the Israelites get some practice walling off territories, and that will come in handy later.
Yes, it will. Things. And then we just start churning through one king after the other. King so-and-so reigned for so many years and did evil by the Lord greater than all the kings before him, and then he died ad infinitum.
Good chapter.
And then we finally meet Elijah, who God is pawning around during a drought, and he's pretty badass, actually. He has birds that feed him.
Yeah, no word on whether they just regurgitated into his mouth.
Ew, ew. And wait, he has magic jars of food, and he even brings kids back from the dead by rubbing his genitals on them.
What was that? I just threw that in there. That was weird stuff. So, three dick rubs resurrects a dead baby. They don't mention this, but if you do it right, that will also get you to the Tootsie Roll center of a Tootsie Pop. That's right. I learned that the hard way. Not the soft way. Well, I tried the soft way, but I learned it the hard way.
So Elijah shows up all Charles Bronson and decides to prove that God's God by challenging the prophets of Baal to a divine ox-burning contest, in which he kicks ass.
Of course.
Then there's some boring war shit, and one king attacks another king, and fuck, I don't even know anymore. Who cares? I don't. All I know is somebody didn't kill the person that God told them to kill, and then so God gets all pissy and does what he does.
He does that.
Right, yeah. And we learn this from this bizarre story involving a masochistic prophet and another divine lion attack.
Right, that's three.
Fucking lions.
At least it didn't talk.
Then Ahab wants Naboth's vineyard, but he won't sell it, so Ahab's wife Jezebel arranges to have him falsely accused and then stoned to death.
That's fair.
Nice
of her. God hears about this and gets all pissed off, so he sends Elijah to tell Ahab he's fucked and that dogs are going to eat his wife.
Right, but Ahab fasts and wears a sack around his body, so God's like, "Ah, shucks, I don't have to kill you and your dogs eat your wife now. I suppose we could save that punishment for your kids and grandkids. It'd be a lot nicer."
What?
For you.
And then the whole book ends with this long, pointless story about Jehoshaphat and the king of Israel wanting to go to war with Ramoth-Gilead, and all but one of the prophets say they'll win, but one prophet says that their other prophets are full of shit, and they were, and who gives a fuck?
And the king gets killed in battle, and just as God has decreed, dogs lap up his blood, and in an understated twist, get this, prostitutes bathe in it, because it's good for the skin.
It's subtle. I'm confused, though, by all the whore talk. Why would there be prostitutes when they had slaves? A slave is the world's oldest profession. It's like buying CDs on Napster. You just don't do that. It doesn't make any sense.
Old school.
That's one mystery. I guess the real mystery of One Kings, though, is how the fuck they managed to finance the sequel. I guess we'll answer that question and many more in 3 weeks. But in the meantime, we'll be washing our brains out with soap. Heath, Lucinda, thanks for sticking with it.
Babble, babble.
Before we bring the final bell tonight, I wanted to make a quick correction. We covered a story last week about public prayer booths in Kansas City, and it was almost completely bullshit. Sorry about that. Another fail in our story vetting process. We'll try to tighten that up. And in the meantime, I want to thank all of our astute listeners who clued us in on that. I also wanted to let everyone know that the nomination phase has started for the second annual Stitcher Awards. Heath, Lucinda, and I really, really, really want to win one of those, and we need your help. You can nominate us up to once per day in as many categories as you think are appropriate. So if you have a few minutes and you're feeling generous this holiday season, please head over to stitcher.promotw.com and nominate the shit out of us. daily. I'm not too proud to beg. You'll also find links to this nomination page on our blog, our Twitter feed, and our Facebook page, because like I said, I'm not too proud to beg. And that's all the blasphemy we have for you this week, but we'll be back in 168 hours with a visit from the friendly atheist himself, Hemant Mehta, so get all excited about that. But if you can't wait that long, be sure to check out episode 33 of the Herd Mentality podcast with Adam Reeks, where you can hear my impression of Joel Osteen orgasming to death on an 8-horsepower turbocharged solid gold butt plug. I need to thank Heath for keeping it real, Lucinda for putting up with the two of us. I want to thank everybody who did some holiday shopping on our cafe press site, and of course a huge thanks to Evan Bernstein from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe for providing this week's Farnsworth quote. He is 1/5 of my all-time favorite podcast. Really cool of him to do it, and of course you'll find a link to his show on this week's show notes right next to the link to nominate us for a Stitcher Award. But most of all, I need to thank this week's most valuable humans, Wayne, Debbie, and Vinny. Wayne, whose ejaculations have seismological designations, and Debbie and Vinny, whose altruism and advice deserves less of a one-liner and more of a very genuine thanks on behalf of both my wife and myself for reminding us that, generally speaking, humans are awesome. And since I already hit you up for that Stitcher nomination, I'm not going to bother reminding you that if you'd like to support the show financially, you'll find the donation button on the right side of the homepage at scathingatheist.com. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find the contact information on the contact page on that very same website. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. Hashtag butt raping Jesus.
Don't forget hashtag butt raping Jesus.